So, my name is Brandon Kaler, and I'm a program manager in Office 365 security. And that means it's kind of a weird organization, but my role is primarily in building tools that do what amounts to customer security analytics and risk management. And over the last year, year and a half or so, I've spent a bunch of time with customers. And I've learned a ton from you guys, and they ask me the same questions over and over and over again. The number one question I get is, I don't know where to start. And so the progenitus of this talk, where it sort of came from, the genesis, is from customers, usually IT directors that are saying, my CXO is like on me. I'm supposed to figure out some sort of strategy to go to the cloud, but I don't know where to start. And so this talk is basically an attempt to frame up a very high level strategy for any size company. And your mileage will vary depending on where you are kind of on the maturity scale. But the concepts are gonna be the same regardless of how big you are, regardless of the industry that you're in, and regardless of the complexity of your hybrid multi-cloud setup. So let me start with a question. How many of you are a CXO or report to a CXO? Handful of you. Okay, good. I'm glad I got you in the room. I'll be excited for question time when we get to the very end. Okay, how many of you are responsible or accountable for security administration of your company in some form or fashion? By and large, the rest of you. Okay, awesome. So we've got the right audience for the most part in the room. Okay, so a couple big takeaways here. When I thought about where do we start with this, a couple of key takeaways I want you to have are the concept of a kill chain. You've probably heard it before, but this strategy that we typically recommend to folks starts with the kill chain, and specifically looking at the kill chain choke points. That's the key attacker vulnerability. You know, we talk all the time about what our risks are. The reality is that attackers have a mirrored set of risks. And because they have to pass through certain points along their attack chain, that's the opportunity for us to catch them or stop them or shut them down or do whatever. Simple breadth strategies are, at least in my experience, have been the most effective. Over-investing in one particular kind of security capability, like some sort of prevention mechanism, and saying, this is how we do it, like saying, we're going to invest in very complicated MFA technologies to protect all of our accounts. We're really not going much further past that. Leads to very damaging breaches because there's always a way around every single possible technology and risk mitigation thing that you put into play. There's a way around it. So that's the third thing in here is to assume breach. Now that's not to say you should assume breach and be sad about it or assume breach because you know you don't want to go to the cloud or whatever. It's assume breach as a way to drive your strategic investment map. All right. So I have this lovely diagram at the bottom, and on the left is representing the people that you have to worry about, external attackers and malicious insiders. Malicious insiders are far and away the more scary one between these two. And then the four kind of high-level categories of threats that you have to worry about, and those are breached account, elevation of privilege, data exfiltration, and data deletion. All right, so just to dive in there. So this talk, I don't know, how many of you been in a talk where you had a terrifying security story told to you this week? Any, a few of them? Okay, great. I'm gonna be the last in a long line of security guys who are gonna tell horrible stories. So these will be illuminating at the very least. So first thing I'm gonna talk about is a breached account. And this woman here clearly has a breached account. She's sort of freaking out about it. All right, so the scenario, these are all real world scenarios. The identities have been changed to protect the privacy of the people, obviously. But this is a spamming executive admin. Basically, a secretary for a relatively small sized company got a phishing email in a consumer email provider. I won't name them, but you can imagine one of a handful that people use as part of their normal workflow. And she got an invoice.doc attachment because it came through a third-party provider. It didn't go through the exchange protections, et cetera, et cetera. And it had a piece of embedded malware. So she's an admin, so it's her job to basically deal with these invoices. So she double-clicks it. It's like, oh, that's weird. It's empty. She closes it and sort of goes on with their day. And essentially what we think happened in working with the customer is that the secretary was a very well-researched, targeted person. She's the only person in the company that got it. They knew that she reported to a high-level executive that could result in a fairly serious breach. And basically, her account creds got dumped to a C2. That's an external a command and control center for the attacker. So the attacker now has her identity and can log in as her. So that exec admin's account was then used to send that invoice.doc malware to the rest of the company, which would be a normal thing, right? The secretary sending out invoices is like what their job is functionally, which of course resulted in subsequent breaches by other people in the company, expanding the account breach. And then a spoofed email was sent to the CFO impersonating the CEO asking for a bank transfer. So by using the secretary's account credentials, they were able to learn who else in the company was responsible or accountable for specific types of roles, because they could log in, they could see the directory, they could see who she's sending email to and so forth. And essentially, you know, a CEO telling a CFO to bank transfer some stuff to close a deal or whatever, it's not an uncommon thing to happen. So of course that bank transfer happened, and they caught it after the transfer had been completed and the money extracted by the attacker. So a basic account cred, a single piece of fairly common malware, resulted in three distinct attacks: a whaling attack, which is the CEO impersonating the CFO, an internal phishing attack with the secretary sending out this invoice.doc, and then the secretary's account being used to send the invoice.doc to other companies, right? So this nearly successful whaling attempt, well actually, this one didn't work, that's right, they caught it, would have been 60K. So the original request came from, was for a 60K transfer. They caught it. They spent hundreds of hours, literally hundreds of hours, to figure out what happened. And this is a small company. I mean, this is like somewhere between 50 and 100 seats. So 60K loss would have been very damaging to their bottom line. They would have a hard time making payroll for something like that. And of course, hundreds of hours of lost productivity. All right, so account breach. What could they have done to prevent this? What could they do to detect it? What could they do to remediate it? So for any given threat vector, that's the three things that you have to think about: the standard, protect, detect, investigate, remediate. To prevent that particular account breach, multi-factor would have been the best, simplest answer, and it is in most cases. A piece of feedback that we often get from our customers is that MFA is a huge hit to user productivity, and they spend a lot of time supporting lost tokens or, you know, frustration with having to log into multiple apps because session states aren't persisted, so on and so forth. Finding a way to get MFA in some form implemented inside of your organizations in a way that protects against the actual threats that you have. And whether that's a conditional MFA where you have MFA when you're logging in from outside the company network, that's what Microsoft does, and that's a fine protection mitigation. It's pretty much the only thing that is available that you can do right now, today, to make sure that those very high value accounts, at the very least, are not trivially breached. Having difficult to crack password policies and at least user education to prevent reuse, people very commonly, because password policies are so aggressive, they're so long, they basically have, I know this is true for me, I can remember basically two passwords. And so reuse is very common if you're not aware of things like password managers, where you can have a complex password to your password manager, and then you have the password manager generate random long strings, and you just go to that guy and paste it into whatever website or whatever account that you need. End user education is key. Secretary had no idea that attachments were a thing that she needed to worry about. And when she double-clicked that invoice and didn't see anything in it, it never occurred to her to report it, right? So it was, you know, a week plus later when they started seeing this invoice.doc turn up on other things and AV starting to trigger on client machines and so forth, that they finally discovered it. So making sure your users are aware of these threat vectors, that they need to not open attachments from, you know, private email on their work machines, and that they're aware that a very simple thing like clicking a link or opening an attachment can lead to a full-scale breach of the entire company. And then, of course, having aggressive anti-malware attachment policies. There's a series of recommendations that I'll kind of make at the very end about how you can protect yourself against that. In many cases, it's just about modernizing what your like document types are that you use. So DOC is a very common attachment type that people don't actually need. Like the DOC is like 6 years old or something like that. If you don't need older style files, ooh, I'm getting a little feedback. Can we crank me down? You can just block those, right? Or you can have fairly aggressive notification policies. If you see big spikes in outbound email for specific accounts, you can say, tell the global admin, and they can go address them. From a detect perspective, what's great about detection, at least in the cloud, is that in getting the data is usually pretty easy. Office 365 has taken some non-trivial steps to try to put all activity data from Azure AD to Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, OneDrive for Business, Skype for Business, all of it into one audit location. So if you have a third-party app that basically serves as your on-prem SIEM, or it's a cloud app security broker, a CASB, they should be able to consume data for the entirety of your Office 365 products from one location, and in theory be able to do detections and remediations and investigations without having to, you know, go figure out how to get Exchange data and figure out how to get SharePoint data independently of each other. So the strategies about how you do that vary, and the cost is, of course, dependent on the scale. We've tried to optimize for the vast majority of these scenarios. So we store audit data in an audit mailbox. And I know that sounds weird. It's you know, we think of our mailboxes as basically user stores now. So there's a tenant audit mailbox that's available in every Office 365 tenant with Exchange attached to it. And when you turn on auditing, all the data flows into that mailbox and is retained for 90 days. You can run a PowerShell query against it. There's a web page that you can go to say, tell me everything that this user did from this date and that time, or tell me all the activities that happened of this particular type. So it's a robust investigation thing. Additionally, we have something called the Activity API, which flows the data out like a fire hose, essentially. Once you turn it on and you point your app at it, it's going to collect all that data at scale just in time. And for large corporations, that can be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes of data per day. So depending on where you are at in the scale in terms of you know, complexity and volume of data will depend on your strategy. And we've made it so that you can do both. Lots of features in that data to drive anomaly detections. The quality of those detections often depends on the platform that you're ingesting it into. I think about them, a detection as being one of three types. There's an atomic detection, which is sending an alert or detection when an event happens of a particular type. And that's basically like you have a single feature, like creation of admins. That's like a thing that should not happen that often. Semi-detection that happens. Second thing is a statistical anomaly. It's like a variance. So if you see greater than one or two standard deviations of this type of activity, I want you to send me an alert, right? So that would be something like a password crack attempt. If you see greater than X number of failed logons from my normalized baseline, then I want you to send me an alert. And the last one is like a full bore, fancy, multi-featured anomaly detection where you're doing set intersection theory, where you're looking at a bunch of variables, where you're looking at time of day, IP address, client type of activity that they're doing, so on and so forth, to construct a very high fidelity alert that comes out of it. The last one is kind of the holy grail of detections, where you're implying intent from a series of things that don't normally carry intent with them. All right, and the last thing is the remediation. And the platform has a bunch of built-in remediation capabilities. Piecing together how you would respond in specific cases is so key. Ask yourself, if I had 1,000 breached accounts, and big companies will have 1,000 breached accounts, like that's something, there's all sorts of clever attacker ways to breach that many accounts kind of all at once. How would you respond if 1,000 accounts were breached today? Do you have a script? Do you have an elevation or escalation process to get the right people involved to help scope that breach? Do you have a way to communicate with your users? How long would it take you to recover from that particular kind of a thing? That all takes planning, right? Second thing is the robustness of the response. Breached accounts, we'll learn here in a minute, isn't the only thing. Being able to think about your cloud assets right next to your on-prem assets, right next to your Salesforce implementation and your AWS stuff and your Azure stuff and all of the stuff that exists in your ecosystem, and being able to have a coherent response, because a breach is going to traverse all those boundaries, right? A breach will start with a Gmail account and it will end up with a cross-platform breach, and you need to be able to track all of that stuff down. So doing tabletop and capture the flag exercises is hugely valuable. My experience is that tabletop exercises is great for communication planning, and capture the flag exercises are great for gap identification, right? So if you get your, if you have a pen test team or you want to hire a pen test team and say, hey, have at it, here's the target, you'll learn all sorts of ways that your detection and investigation or remediation strategies can fail. I'm from Seattle, and we have Seattle Seahawks. Russell Wilson is our quarterback, and he's sort of famous for saying the separation is in the preparation. So that's also true for security. All right, elevation of privilege is the next case that I'm going to talk about here. In this particular case, it all starts with an administrator account. The case happened kind of in the fall of last year, and I call it the airport admin because it's an administrator account that they actually don't know how it was breached, how the account credential was breached. It was likely that it was an airport kiosk cred dump, right? So the global admin, relatively small company, again, I think they had about 250 seats, and he had just taken a trip and he had just did like a 2-minute log on an airport kiosk to check his email really quickly. There's no other way that he was able to identify that his creds could have been stolen. So we're assuming that it was the airport kiosk, right? There's a handful of ways where that could have been fairly straightforward. The attacker, in a very short amount of time, from the time that he had that log on in the airport to the time when the first set of attack activities had been completed, we were able to sort of reconstruct, was about 20 minutes. So the attacker created a shadow admin account via PowerShell, and then used that to create a regular user account. And then he deleted the shadow admin account. The regular user account was granted delegate permissions to a payables clerk. So a payables clerk account basically granted this regular user account delegate permissions. And then they created mail forwarding rules to an external domain, to a Yahoo account, in the account payable clerk's account. So the account payables clerk has no idea that this mail forwarding rule has been created. There is no global admin that's sort of hanging around. It's just this regular user account that's got a regular user's name in it. It was completely indistinguishable in the list. They spent about a week doing nothing, basically just gathering intelligence on accounting and downstream payments, right? So this is like 2 minutes, a simple script. They're now watching information, it's data exfiltration. They're just reading this email and sort of reconstructing who the payables clerk talks to and who talks to the payables clerk and all that kind of stuff. And then they sent a single email from an Azure-hosted domain that had basically two letters of a customer of the customer. So we'll call it like the third-party customer here. They spoofed their domain, got a transposed letter domain, pretended like they were the payables clerk in the other tenancy, and sent an email to the payables clerk. And they said, hey, we just changed our bank. Can you update this routing number? Payables clerk's like, sure. I mean, I know who you are. It's like your first name at domain looks like it's totally your domain. There's no red flags in there. It looks like a totally legit thing. And so they then proceeded to update the bank routing information. They made 6 weeks of $30,000 a week payments before the downstream customer's like, you guys haven't paid me in 6 weeks. Like, what's up? Before they realized, wow, we have really, really screwed this up. So in the final washout, it was over $200,000 worth of financial loss. The customer's customer, of course, was like, man, I don't know if I can trust you to pay me now. Is this broken trust relationship that was very, very harmful for the company. Of course, the hundreds of hours of investigation, hundreds of hours of remediation, and then lots and lots of lost productivity, right? So kind of a worst case scenario. So this is a very high level account, an admin account. They can do pretty much anything in the tenancy with one log on, the $200,000 log on. All right, what could they have done about it? Again, the strategy here is prevent, detect, remediate. For prevent, multi-factor, of course, especially for global admins, is the best, simplest answer. And as the CEO or CXO of your company or the director of IT security, your global admins are going to complain at you all day long. It's so hard, blah, blah, blah. Don't listen to them. Go ahead and enable MFA. As a representative of Microsoft, I know that there are gaps in that requirement. There are like PowerShell interfaces that don't necessarily accept MFA and so forth. But there's always a way around it. We've been working on PowerShell interfaces that do support MFA. Most of them are in preview, but you can get access to them now. Forcing your global admins to use alt accounts. So if they just need to check their email, they don't need global admin privileges to check their email, right? So have them have a secondary account that they use to do service administration. And make that service administration privilege just in time. There's a product that Microsoft ships called Privileged Identity Manager out of Azure AD. They can, with two clicks, go in and elevate their alt account to global admin privileges for 4 hours, do the thing they need to do, and then de-escalate. It dramatically reduces that threat, that surface area. Make a very high bar for admin access. Like I said, you don't need to do basic things, edit Word docs and so forth as global admin. Have a workflow where you request permission to do a particular type of task, to do global administration. If it's something that's repetitive, figure out how to automate it, right? Your global admins should be intervening for exception cases. If it's something like creating new accounts or whatever, have an automated process that just does that so you don't have to have a person logging into that kind of global admin access. Also maintain a small admin user base. So our recommendation, regardless of your company size, and you may call me out on this, we say that you should have more than one, which is to say at least two, but no more than five global admins in your company. So whether that's standing or just in time and so forth, Microsoft as a corporation has 250,000 plus employees, and our global admin community is just a hair over 10. So you can do it. It's hard. It's work, but you can get down there. All right. Detection here. This is a focus on a specific subtype of activity. So super, ultra, mega, look at admin activity. It's fairly easy to get. Most of the search interfaces, the scope query interfaces for activity data allow you to look at just admin activity. It's like a top-level thing. Just show me admin stuff. Review it and make them the priority detection. When you're thinking about, all right, so I have to do some kind of detection capability. What's my test case? Admin MFA, admin creation, and the like, admin activity just in general, that's what you should be looking at. It should be a small volume, which makes it easy, and it's very high risk. It's high noise, which is to say it's very rare that there's an actual admin account breach. So you'll spend a lot of time looking at alerts being like, not an actual breach. But it's given the risk profile of an admin account breach, it's worth the time and effort to review that activity. And again, there's lots of features to drive this: IP address, time of day, the action that's performed, the user agent. There's also a lot of data that's included in the model that is workload specific, right? So there's information in Exchange and SharePoint and OneDrive for Business that will help you contextualize what a user is doing for that particular thing. So it's complete, it's comprehensive, and relatively concise. All right, remediation. For a lot of this stuff, people want to focus on the speed of the remediation. And this would seem like wisdom, but for the warning in my heart. Investigation and scoping capability is a better priority. What we find is that when corporations get breached with admin accounts, is that they basically reset the admin account password or enable MFA on it, and then they're like, sweet, I'm done, right? That's in the case of an elevation of privilege attack, you have to spend a lot of time investigating to make sure, to prove and double prove that you have the full scope of the breach, right? It's very easy for an attacker to entrench themselves in your organization without you having any idea, right? Like in this particular case, admin user, regular user, delete admin user. So they're in your org and you don't have like the super loud, obvious, you know, 20% of your global admins is, you know, an attacker kind of a thing. So you have to look at everything. ACLs, mail config, new and changed accounts, all of that stuff could represent entrenchment. So when we think about account breaches, we typically look at the account and what did the account do, but you have to remember that traversing from that account to other accounts and traversing from those other accounts into other sorts of exfiltration or entrenchment strategies, very easy for an attacker to do. They're very sensitive about how loud they're being inside of your environment. So take the time to do a proper breach scoping, and as a leader in your company, set a high bar. Make your security administrators prove to you that the attacker is not somewhere else. And even if at the point at which they say, yeah, okay, it's good enough for now, assume breach, right? Assume that the attacker is still in there and that you need to constantly be vigilant. All right, third one, data exfiltration and deletion. This is you get a twofer on this story. There's actually two little mini stories here. One about ransomware and one about, let's see, what is this? This is another invoice routing kind of a thing. So in the first case of ransomware, basically a global admin that had not yet moved to the cloud for their document data logged into his desktop workstation, and the way that their company worked, they had a file server that was on-prem, and that file server the global admin had mounted on his local desktop. Logged in, got an email with an attachment in it, looked legit, double-clicked it, turns out it was ransomware. And so the ransomware zipped up all the data on his computer, including all the data on the mounted drives. So it was gigabytes and gigabytes of data that had been zipped up, basically the entire, every piece of data that the company had, the single point of failure. In the other case, a payables clerk got a phishing link to a faked federated auth page. Attackers can be very sophisticated about their attacks. We've done a bunch of research about the effectiveness of phishing. I'm sure you'll hear this in industry a lot. There's not a lot that you can do to reduce the effectiveness of phishing against your users. And because it all turns on the quality of the phishing attack. It is relatively cheap for an attacker to make a phishing attack look like the real deal, right? And they understand the psychology of your users to appeal to the thing that's gonna make them click that really fast. So as an example, when we ran a spear phishing campaign in Microsoft for a caffeine-free workplace, right? So it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. We said, hey, click here if you want to give us feedback. We're thinking about removing caffeine from the workplace, right? We got about a 10% breach rate on that, right? It's very obviously a thing that, you know, we're trying to spearfish you. But then we ran a Seahawks game day giveaway, right? So a lot of Seahawks fans in Seattle, we said, you know, click here to enter a raffle to win a ticket to go see the Seahawks play and catch a pass from Russell Wilson. It's going to be awesome. We had something like a 40% success rate on that. So, and this is after, you know, the users know that they're being attacked. And we see it pretty consistent, whether they're global admins or security guys. Our security guys get breached at the exact same rate that our regular users get breached at. So just being aware of security risks or stuff, you still get suckered in, especially when you're receiving thousands of emails a day. Like sometimes companies, it's overwhelming. And you're just like, okay, yeah, I got that thing to do and that thing to do and that thing to do. It's just another thing in the list. So in this particular case, an attacker had created a federated auth page that looked exactly like the company's normal federated auth page. So, you know, you'll see this very often. You click on a link and there's an internal tool and you go to this like company branded page. It's got your logo on it. It's got your username and password. You type it in and it takes you to the thing, right? Microsoft has a ton of these. We have the guy, it's a guy on a bicycle with a helmet, and he's kind of got this, you know, kind of sideways look at you. We all hate the bike helmet guy. That federated auth page is trivial for a company, an attacker, to go scrape and create a phishing site that does that. So when, you know, this payables clerk clicked on it, it looked like a normal logon, username and password, click save, and then it, you know, sent it to a 404 page. It didn't actually redirect them to the link that they thought they were getting. But at that point, it's game over. The payables clerk's thing is done. They think, oh, maybe it was like a weird network thing, you know, whatever, on with their day. Once they had that that credential, the attacker created a forwarding rule. By the way, forwarding rule. You probably have no idea today how many people have forwarding rules to external domains inside your tenancy. It's trivial to create them. Lots and lots of people do it, and it is a huge data exfiltration point. So you figure out how to, well, there'll be a script that I'll show you guys at the very end that allows you to dump that so you can monitor it and baseline it over time. So the attacker created a forwarding rule for everything with the word invoice in it to an external domain, and then they just basically edited the invoice. So they took this invoice.doc that had been going out to a customer, and they took it and they modified it after it had been sent, and basically sent it on to the downstream customer with a name that looked a lot like the payables clerk. As it turns out, it was from a @Gmail account, so the downstream customer maybe should have noticed that the payables clerk of this company probably wouldn't send me an invoice for you know, however much this was from an @Gmail account, but you know, they did it anyway. And they ended up paying the company, but to the edited bank routing number, and it was basically like a $100,000 payment. That's, you know, lost. The payables clerk, you know, 2 weeks later is like, hey, how come you haven't made the payment? Downstream customer says, I paid it like 2 weeks ago. What are you talking about? And they sort of figure it out from there. For the ransomware guy, he basically paid the ransom. And this is a consideration that you should make. You should have a good ransomware plan, especially if you run production systems that have any kind of customer data, your customer data, not only your corporate data, but your downstream customers' data, have a strategy in place. It is fairly easy, like a two-click easy, to have all of your data get encrypted and wrapped up with some kind of ransomware. One of the most effective things that you can do here is to make sure you have good backup strategies and that you do things like adopt cloud services. Like just having their data in OneDrive for Business would have saved this guy all that data. Like he lost gigabytes and gigabytes of user data, and if he'd had it in OneDrive for Business, he would have been able to recover fairly straightforwardly. All right, same sort of thing here, customer trust impact, hundreds of hours of investigation, remediation, so on and so forth. All right, so what could we have done to prevent these two specific attacks? ACL, sharing policies, least privilege, data classification, DLP, blah, blah, blah. It's like dozens of different features that can help you as a customer built into the platform keep your data safe and secure. And the best strategy is one that employs all of them. No one of them is going to work sort of out of the box. No one of them covers all the scenarios. It's just a question of having a robust governance policy about this is how we manage our data. This is how we prevent these specific types of attacks. As I mentioned earlier, leveraging the cloud for data resiliency. When you adopt a cloud service, you're functionally putting a breach boundary in place, a firewall between an attacker's ability to operate and the cloud service provider. So an attacker might be able to breach your corporate network, but they will have a much harder time breaching Microsoft's corporate network and getting into our data centers. They can basically get one or the other, but not both, right? And then having healthy on-prem infrastructure. When you think about the interaction model, as a user, a device, and the data. That device piece often gets underlooked because there's been so much pressure to sort of, you know, let people use their own devices for this. Letting people use their personal phones, letting people log on from home or whatever, should do that, but you should still maintain that they patch those computers, that they have antivirus and anti-malware software running on it. Wow, that was intense. That they have firewalls in place and so forth. And there are ways to do that with mobile device management, Intune, and the like. So let your users be productive, but make them meet a min bar for a lot of this kind of stuff. All right, so detection, anomaly detection is hard for access to data because it's so spiky. There's a high variability in the access patterns. For any given user, they might spend a week where they're doing a lot of collaboration on one or more documents and then a week with nothing, right? So figuring out an anomaly in when the data is so highly variable, it's somewhat difficult. So the key here is to focus on mechanisms, right? How is the attacker gonna get data out of your environment? Mail forwarding rules, as I mentioned, is a key mechanism. Focusing on large downloads, attackers are very aware of how long it takes to do particular types of things. And they're not gonna do the slow roll, right? They're not gonna do the, I'm gonna steal a doc a day for the next 6 years, right? If they're trying to target a particular thing, they're looking for the quick bang, write a script, download all the stuff, and get out kind of a thing. So if you, that gives you an opportunity to catch them at the point at which they're trying to implement something that you know that they really want to do, which is a fast data exfil. And then any kind of sharing policy changes. So if your governance policy works in the right way, you allow sharing. That's a great productivity tool, allows your users to interact with each other and with your external partners. But do things like force guest access links to expire after 30 days. Right? That's fairly straightforward. We found that the vast majority of doc collaboration happens inside the first 2 weeks. So make it so those guest access links expire after 30 days. And that means that if that third party gets breached, that your document won't be exposed to them unnecessarily for long periods of time. Right? Last point here is accept that the detection mechanism is most often an external, and that stuff is well after the damage is done. So what you're detecting is that a breach happened. You're not detecting that a breach is in motion or a breach is about to happen, and that's why the planning is so key here. So for the remediation, accept that the cat is not in the bag. The cat is out of the bag at the point at which your data has been lost or stolen. Then that data exfiltration is almost always the goal, especially with APT. Like, they want to get data out of your environment. And we've seen all kind of surprising amounts of data. Sometimes they're looking for directory data. They just want to know what your org structure is so they know who to target. Sometimes they're going after source code. Sometimes they're going after bug lists. Sometimes they're going after financial information. Sometimes they're going after like CEO email to look for, you know, specific types of IPO information. Sometimes they're looking for technical information if you're running like a particular kind of service, like you're a water company. They want to understand how that stuff gets managed or blueprints for specific types of things. There's a type of data that exists in your organization. An attacker can invent a way or think of a way to either monetize it or use it to attack you in downstream. Right? So finding the mechanism is often the hardest bit of this. And again, you should focus on a robust investigation and scoping capability here. Protection, have a good, robust strategy there, but take yourself past that. Think, okay, let's assume that all this stuff that we're doing to protect ourselves from this kind of a breach doesn't work. How would I reconstruct this? How would I make sure that I could fix it authoritatively? How could I tell my board later that we're clear of this, and that we can, you know, get the Wall Street Journal on the phone and say, we are now fully recovered. More importantly, you want to be able to scope a breach relatively quickly so that you can tell your customers and tell the world that this was the extent of it, right? There's a lot of frustration in the customer base at large about how long it takes for companies to figure out how bad it is. And you get these announcements, like happened last week, like 150 million accounts or 500 million, it's like some crazy number, 2 years ago. You know, and customers hear about that, they're like, what? You're telling me 2 years after the breach happened? Very frustrating for them, right? So equip yourself with something that highlights that you have thought about what the risk is involved in here and that you're responding to it very effectively. Tabletop capture flag exercises are key in sort of pinning this stuff down. All right, so for the last one, I'm not brave enough to tell a malicious insider story. I'm sure all of you have a malicious insider story that you're aware of. Disgruntled employees, people that are, you know, in the middle of divorces or whatever, just need an extra buck and they do something that's a little shady or a little under the table and so forth. So I don't have a great story, but just in your mind, replace it with your own malicious insider story. And this is basically the scenario, all the other ones added up, except it's somebody that knows how all of your stuff works, that knows exactly where the targets are, that knows exactly how your organization is constructed, that knows how to detect and remediate, that knows all the stuff. All right, so how do you prevent this sort of a thing? This all starts with pre-planning. You have an assumed breach mindset, and you have to account for the malicious insider scenario right up front. It should be part of your tabletop planning. You should say, okay, what do we do if you, like, and you point at your director and say, let's say you start to hate me, what can you do to damage me? Like, what would be the things? Does it get awkward? Maybe it's fun, I don't know. Do it over a beer. But make sure that you have a documented plan for how to handle a malicious insider. And that includes figuring out how to like lock them down, lock them out without them necessarily being tipped off, because you're likely gonna wanna prosecute that person. Least privilege, just-in-time access for administrative activity is very important. We found that a lot of malicious insider activity happens after hours. So you know, they come in, they do their job during the day, they go home, they VPN in, they do the naughty. You should also construct your systems to require collusion. So if you have approval workflows to do specific types of high-risk activities, make it so that one guy can't approve his own stuff, right? Make it so that sensitive activities, being able to change sharing policies or promote global admins, requires at least two people. And it's not to say that there won't be a way to defeat that. It's not to say that they won't get collusion, but require it as a min bar. And then detecting these sorts of scenarios is so interesting. These are it's very common for these scenarios to just happen for a long time, years, before they finally get detected. When they do get detected, it's never through some fancy system, right? It's almost always like reported, hey, I noticed something weird. So make it a standard policy in your organizations that people can report suspicious behavior in a safe way, that they can do it without fear of retribution, that they can do it in a way that doesn't, you know, cast aspersions on their coworkers, but it gives you a way to have a handle, an indicator of a potential compromise that you can then take and go investigate. Right? So your people are pretty good detectors of things that are weird. We're pretty good anomaly detectors. And it's most likely the case that in a malicious insider case, that somebody that works around them is aware that there's something weird going on. For the detection capability, it's all the same stuff. For detecting an account breach, for detecting an elevation of privilege, data deletion, data exfiltration, the detections are exactly the same for a malicious insider as they are for an external attacker. And as I said earlier, they're slightly less good because that person is already inside your organization and logging in, and they know how all this stuff goes, and they know how to hide their tracks, right? So that's why the involving the people element of this is so crucial. All right, it's also the hardest scenario to remediate. As in the previous scenario, I mentioned that you have to spend a lot of time investigating like an admin account breach. This exact same thing here is that you can lock them out, you can fire them, you can, you know, ship them off to the cops or whatever, but you're gonna spend months and months and months reconstructing everything they did, all the access that they had to all the different things that they had access to. You need to be really confident that you got everything, right? Because backdoors, they're hard to get rid of. All right. Give it time, be data-driven. You're gonna be desperate to just move past it and force yourself to double-check and triple-check and quadruple-check to make sure you got everything. All right, so big takeaways. Protect, detect, investigate. Those are the three musketeers of your security strategy. You should center your strategy around three entities: accounts, privilege, and data. Acknowledge that people are usually the weakest link, and that's not to say that your employees are bad people. It just means that they're people. You're just as bad as they are. You're likely gonna click on a phishing link at some point in your career, and that education is crucial. And not the like kind of top-down corporate, you know, you gotta take the you know, don't do insider trading training kind of a thing, but to just help them be aware of what the real-world threats are and how your organization is vulnerable and how they can play a part in protecting that. So to be an inclusive message, and it should be one that that emphasizes the acknowledgement that mistakes sometimes happen and that it's never too late to do the right thing, right? Not a fear-based strategy, but a you know, help us help the company handle these sorts of threats. The strategy has to secure cloud and on-prem together. Office 365 takes a lot of responsibility and accountability for making sure that our customers are secure. But it's only half the risk, or half of the attack surface. So whatever strategies that you have for on-prem today, those should be extended to include all your cloud stuff, right? So however you detect illicit activity on your machines, if you have log scanning, if you have reports that you look at, figure out how to get your cloud services incorporated in that same picture. Don't do two, don't do four, do one, just make that one be inclusive of hybrid and on-prem. And that, lastly, big bang efforts, it's a lot of corporate policy requires that you have robust funding and resource allocation. You're trying to figure out, like, we're going to do this big thing. What's the capitalizable cost? It all has implications for the bottom line. It's a really loud beep. Incremental change is faster than big bang efforts. And so figuring out what you can do today that will have relatively low user impact, I'll show you a tool here in a second that'll let you do that. That is, it's way faster, way better approach than being like, okay, we have these two big rocks that we have to move. There are 20 things that you could do today to secure yourself. All right, so the URL at the bottom here is called securescore.office.com. And what that is a security and risk management analytics tool that works for all of our multi-tenant customers today. Microsoft has taken a baseline of about 77 security controls across Azure AD, Exchange, SharePoint, OneDrive for Business, Skype for Business, and the like, and given them a score. And then we measure the extent to which you've adopted that baseline, and then we give you a score. And what it tells you is the things that you've adopted and the things that you could adopt, inclusive. You don't have to go to six different security centers. It's stack ranked in a way that you see the most important, lowest impact things at the top of the list. And the remediation for it, the execution, is usually two clicks. Learn more, it'll tell you what you're about to do, why it's important, and then a button to just do that thing. So we're trying to bring everything together into a single pane of glass, if you will, at least in terms of security planning and action. The Secure Score does that. Another thing, the content of this talk that I just went through started with this blog post down here addressing your CXO's top five cloud security concerns on this blog, which is the Securing Office 365 blog. You can find it by doing a search. You can Google it on Bing, Securing Office 365 TechNet, and it'll be one of the top results here. And you should point your security administrators to this because it's basically a set of canonical how-tos. How to fix a compromised account, how to review and mitigate the impact of phishing, how to deal with ransomware, how to get Office 365 data to facilitate a cybersecurity thing. In the cybersecurity article, there's a list of third-party providers, third-party security ISVs, that have built first-party integrations with the Activity API data that you can just, if you have that platform, it's trivial to get the data into it. Right? We've taken the time to grow this this ecosystem of ISVs that help bridge that hybrid and multi-cloud thing. All right, with the no minutes that we have left, are there any questions or comments or feedback? No? Oh yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that's a good piece of feedback. So the comment here is essentially that too many of our tools require global admin to get to them. Unfortunately, the Secure Score is one of them. We're aware of it. We're working hard to get those rules defined so that non-global admin people can go and monitor stuff and configure it and do all that other stuff. So it's appreciated feedback and spot on. All right, other questions? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I'm having a hard time hearing you. I see. Okay. I'm not catching the word. Do you want to step up to the mic or? Oh, DMARC and DKIM. Yeah.
So I'm missing really a push to get these kinds of standards more widely adapted.
Yeah. Interesting. That's not even on my Secure Score list, although the feedback is legit. So DMARC and DKIM are technologies that make your email transport better. Essentially, it makes you a trusted person so people can sort of verify that you're who you say you are, and you can do the same thing with other people so that you're not, you know, some new guy who just spins up a VM in Azure and starts sending mail out of it. You can be like, you're not reputable, right? So our intention, and my understanding there is kind of features and functionality in place to do this, is that that's all enabled by default, that you don't have to do anything to make DMARC, DKIM, and these other sorts of advanced email protections work, right? So I've seen that there are previews that are in place, and customers are slowly being rolled into it. My marketing guys are here up front. They actually know more about a lot of this stuff than I do. They'll confirm for me whether that's the case. But it's good feedback. All right, other questions? Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. There's multiple questions in there. let's try to figure out which one to answer. So the question about a detection capability, a robust real-time detection capability. So there's a capability in the Security Compliance Center today to do an atomic detection. Basically what you describe. The latency isn't what it should be, and my sense is that it's not as actionable as it should be. Basically, you get a notification, but you still have to go and figure out what that is and figure out what the right thing to do is or whatever. There are a ton of platforms that are out there that do some of this. So we're working in parallel, where we're trying to enable these CASBs and these SIEMs to do a robust near real-time detection capability and have those workflows, because we want to bridge that gap, while at the same time having a native capability that's more basic, right? So the focus here is on a basic capability that's faster and faster and more actionable, and then what we're looking to enable for downstream apps, the CASBs, is a more sophisticated anomaly detection, so it's less noise, right? So like in the case of a global admin creation, that doesn't happen that often in most companies. When it does, it's usually okay, but there's lots of other admin activity that you're gonna wanna do like real anomaly detection on to be able to do that. So our Microsoft strategy isn't to be like, we're going to build the detection, at least on Office 365, like the best anomaly detector or whatever. We don't have access to enough of the data, right? So you have to have access to all the stuff to be able to do that. So there was another question in there, which I had an answer for, which I can't remember. Shoot. What was it?
Let me chime in on the anomaly piece. So in Office 365, we do some of that today as part of our advanced security management product. So you can get anomaly detection and some activity detections that you set up as part of the service. So it's an E5 product, or you can buy it as a standalone option to your E3 tenant. So that's something you might want to look at. It has effectively some of the functionalities that CASBs do offer, and it's powered off of our cloud app security product that we also sell that's a cross-cloud solution. So you may want to take a look at that too.
Yeah, it's there. All right, other questions? This is like your last chance to ask a question of an Ignite speaker of the whole week. Make it a good one. Yeah, all right, brave soul. Yeah, come up to the mic. It's really weird and echoey in here, isn't it? Harley, I feel, yeah. Anyway.
So I was wondering, what's Microsoft's stance on requirements from some of the product teams to bypass security controls, such as proxies, SSL inspection, when it comes to client to Office 365 services access?
So the question is, what's Microsoft's policy around proxies? Like, what, you know, do we have any like recommendations or configurations or? The short answer is, I guess I want to say no. Microsoft is very aware of the fact that your security boundary extends into our service and our data centers. What we worry about is that proxy solutions reduce the effectiveness of our service, right? So as an example, there's lots of proxies that encrypt data that transport into it so that all mail, for example, or all docs are just encrypted blobs in our service. Right? At that point, you're protected against the Microsoft data center breach, but that's the least of your worries, right? And you've now denuded our ability to index your content so that you can do a search against it or route it to specific places or whatever. There's a bunch of different types of proxy solutions that we've seen out there. You know, sometimes it's, you know, route mail in and then bounce it out to the service provider and then bring it back in and do whatever. We try to balance between the usability and the stability of the chain of things that have to process it to get you the type of functionality that you need. And in most cases, like a redirect or a proxy solution that takes data in, routes it through a third thing, and then back into us is for a particular reason. Like you've got some kind of on-prem thing that you have to support, whether it's inbound or outbound. But we're very aware that if our services are slow, because the chain, the end user experience is having to go through that full chain of stuff, that we have to, it has to feel fast. And so we're never gonna allow like a third party shim between two of our own components, right? So we sometimes get that where a CASB will wanna do DLP policy analysis on content at scale. So they wanna basically be a shim or some sort of a proxy between, you know, our front-end clients and our actual data stores. And in general, we don't allow that just because it has to be super fast, and the way that we scale doesn't support like a third-party service provider for that kind of stuff. So it, can you ask that question one more time? Oh, I see. Are we lowering your security posture? Yeah, I'm going to give you you're going to hate this answer. This answer is no. I think that when you come to the cloud, that you're actually more secure. Now, I owe you a good explanation of why that's the case, right? When you're on-prem, you have control over everything. When you're in the cloud, you don't. So in many ways, you're basically ceding trust to us to make sure that your data in our data center is not breachable. I can do like a 3-hour presentation on all the security technologies that we have in our data centers to make sure that your data does not get breached out of that. And as an example, you know, Office 365 has 4,000 engineers that work on the service across all the whatevers. Those 4,000 engineers have something approaching zero access to your customer data. There's hundreds of thousands of machines all over the world that operate our service, and we have almost no touch to it. We go to some computer, we go through some elaborate process to say, elevate, go do this thing, yeah, you do it. We don't RDP to boxes. Like, we don't remote PowerShell into boxes and do things to your data to protect it. It's a huge long list of technologies that basically encompass all that stuff. So our sense is that our data center it's gonna be more secure than yours just because the volume and the scale that we have to operate at requires us to automate everything. And that dramatically reduces the attack surface area, all of our people, that an attacker can exploit to get into the data center. So that's one thing. The other thing is that when you come to the cloud, it's not just you, right? It's you plus millions of other customers that are in there. And the way that we've leveraged the power of one person being poked, being attacked, we can detect that, we can inoculate the entire rest of the customer base against that particular type of attack. When we blacklist an IP address for being a spammer or for being a phisher, because they attacked you, you're protected going forward, but customer over here is also protected from that IP address and so forth. So you're accruing value from the fact that you're basically teaming up with all the other customers that are in the service and basically getting the whatever they're being attacked by, you're earning that, if you will. You're sort of getting the value of their stripes on their back. So there'll be a blog on this I've been working on that basically articulates a full set of reasons why we think the cloud is more secure than on-prem. The key, I think, is that we're asking you to trust us, but we have to enable you to verify, right? It's this you know, we're going to tell you everything that we do, but you have to be able to verify that all the things we say we do, we're actually doing, and that your data is actually as secure. And a lot of that is transparency, having the Activity API and the like, and a lot of that is things like customer lockbox, where we make it so that we have to involve you in the escalation process in order to be able to get to it.
Yeah. Is that the release of customer lockbox?
Yeah, it's in the market now. You can buy it. I think you can even buy it right straight from your Office 365 portal. It's part of E5, but you can also buy it standalone. So our hope is that you'll never need it because we don't have to access your data. But yeah, it's available today.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you. Any other questions? No? All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.